I'm going to talk today about space travel through the atmosphere. I guess point up here. But I want to do something else. I was at a meeting a little while back with a bunch of other physicists from Canada, and there were quantum and we introduced ourselves, and there were quantum physicists and atomic physicists and plasma physicists. And it came to me, and I said, well, I'm an atmospheric physicist. And they said, well, what are you doing on our committee? Shouldn't you be on geophysics? And there was sort of a slight contempt in that statement. And then it reminded me of a statement that Sheldon Cooper made on the sitcom Big Bang Theory when he proudly said, geophysics is not real physics, and promptly got shot down by a bunch of paintballs. Served him right. So what I wanted to do today is point out to you that to me, physics is about, firstly, thinking inside the box. You use the existing laws to predict things as well as you can, and then the fun bit comes when you realize that the existing laws don't work, and you have to think outside the box and come up with concepts which hadn't been dealt with before. And there's a sort of a belief that that's unique to cosmology and quantum mechanics and sort of exotic fields, but in fact, it happens as much in atmospheric physics as it does in any other physics. And so I wanted to make that a secondary theme of my talk. So just to give you some idea that atmospheric physics is not just about... the idea is, you know, we're in the atmosphere, we can see it, we look up at the clouds, everything around us we can touch, so it can't be too challenging, right? You just make a few measurements, do a few graphs, and then you make the predictions for the future. So I thought I'd just show you that atmospheric physics has actually been populated by a few heavy hitters in the time. Nobel Prize winners start with Rayleigh and Appleton. Appleton discovered the ionosphere. Brown and Marconi, who discovered radio waves, and that was a very key part of atmospheric research because the way people communicated around the world at those times was to reflect radio signals off the ionosphere. Van der Waals, Compton and Wilson, you've probably heard of the Wilson Cloud Chamber, which was the most important instrument for particle physics for about 50 years, from the 1930s to the 1980s, was invented by Wilson, and Wilson was an atmospheric physicist. His area of research was lightning studies. Without his knowledge of supersaturation and processes in the atmosphere, the Wilson Cloud Chamber would have never been developed. Then we go into Raman, who did optics. And in chemistry, we have quite a few heavy hitters as well. Arrhenius, who worked on the greenhouse effect, Langmuir, Debye, Hertzberg, Crutzen, Molin, Rowland, and even more recently, the Nobel Peace Prize from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We all know how important that is in view of the current predictions with global warming. Other notables, Lorentz developed chaos theory. Lorentz was a meteorologist. And people have ranked the discovery of chaos theory along the same level of importance as that of quantum mechanics in the last century. You will know about chaos theory, the butterfly flapping its wings in Mexico and causing a tornado in Texas. But Lorentz was a meteorologist. Richardson, anyone who's worked on fluids knows the importance of Richardson. Fourier, you've all worked with Fourier series. Fourier's area of research was heat transport. And he particularly got involved in greenhouse studies of the atmosphere. And then fluids, Rossby, Bjerknes, Prandtl, von Karman. So these are pretty heavy hitters. We got some pretty serious people leading us. If you do atmospheric physics, you actually need a very solid background in a whole variety of fields, electromagnetism, if you want to study the ionosphere, radio waves, thermodynamics, very, very important for studies, particularly of water vapor transport in the atmosphere. Optics, fluids, nonlinear processes, gas kinetics, radar, signal processing, quantum mechanics, very important for a lot of the radiation mechanisms that occur in the atmosphere, scattering theory, computer modeling. The biggest computer in Canada is under the Environment Canada building in Duval for weather forecasting. Chemistry, and of course another big thing about atmospheric physics is it's got jobs. Environment Canada is the biggest employer of physicists in Canada. So there's a lot going for atmospheric physicists, us humble geophysicists. So I wanted to press on now and get back to the theme, and that is looking at taking a spacecraft and moving it up through space, flying through the atmosphere, and eventually out into space, and what hazards we might meet along the way. Now, there's two ways to deal with hazards. One is the Star Trek sort of way, where you meet them and boldly blow the bad guys up and everything else. The other thing to do, of course, is to plan for it, so you know what's coming, and so this gets us into the area of forecast. You know, when aircraft were first developed, it was a risky business, people died, but now aircraft is one of the safest forms of flight, and you would hope that eventually would do the same with space travel. So we get to weather forecasting, and that gets us to computer models, and that gets us to to making predictions of what's coming. So with current computer models, what do we want to know? Well, what current forecast? We want to know how much sunshine there's going to be on the ground, how much cloud, how much rain there might be, maybe what the temperature is going to be, maybe the humidity level and the wind speeds, and that pretty much keeps us happy. But there's a whole bunch of extra complexities that come into it when you go into the upper atmosphere. If you're going to fly into just even modern-day flying, you need to have turbulence maps of what's happening in the upper troposphere and the stratosphere. So that gives us some extra complications. But we want to look at what extra fits in as we try and launch off into space travel. And space travel is likely to be something that will become fairly standard within the next 50 years, provided humankind can last another 50 years, which some people draw into question. So let's put ourselves into perspective a little bit before I do that. Here's planet Earth seen from space, from the moon actually. And I want to firstly show you its environment. It's surrounded by a large plasma region called the plasmasphere. We're going to concentrate actually in the lower regions of the atmosphere, but I just wanted to give you an idea of how far this extends. This is mainly due to the magnetic field of the Earth. And as our previous, and you can see why our previous speaker made the comment that the best way to wipe an atmosphere out is to remove the magnetic field, because this magnetic field is protecting us. It also can be pretty nasty, and it harbors a lot of radiation belts and so forth, so it has positives and negatives, but show me something in the life that doesn't have a positive and a negative at the same time. Everything is shades of gray, nothing is black and white. So this thing actually is going to disappear on us in about 1,000 years' time. When the magnetic fields of the Earth reverse, we're going to lose all this. And so people haven't really thought that far ahead, but we're looking at a time when we have a very different Earth when the magnetic field changes. But at the moment, we can consider it as a nice little protection mechanism. If you look at the atmosphere itself, this is drawn to scale. This little blue ring shows the depth of the atmosphere relative to the radius of the Earth. And this is the depth to 100 kilometers. And it's pretty thin. We live in the lowest kilometer, perhaps, and that I couldn't even fit on there. So you can see we live a pretty fragile existence on this ball floating around in space, surrounded by all these nasties, magnetic fields protecting us a little bit, but there's a lot of stuff out there that we have to worry about when we travel. And 90% of this atmosphere is below 10 kilometers. So we're pretty vulnerable. We have to look after what we've got. If I take that 100-kilometer region that I drew as that little blue line and break it down, we have a temperature profile that looks like the following. The troposphere where we live, so we live basically down in this very lowest region here. Temperature decreases as we go up in height because most of the heating of the atmosphere occurs by re-radiation from the ground. You hopefully learned that when you did geography or something. A secondary layer up here, which is increasing in temperature because of UV, ultraviolet radiation from the sun interacting with oxygen and producing ozone, and this region actually protects us from ultraviolet light reaching the ground, which would cause a lot of damage. Then we have a region up here where the temperature decreases, where the Earth radiates back to space. It radiates at infrared wavelengths, like a standard black body radiator. And it has to do that because we have to get rid of the energy we get from the sun, so there has to be a balance. And this is where the radiation occurs. And above that, we have direct ionization. We want to fly all the way through this region. So back to rocketry. The first serious rockets were actually developed during World War II by the Germans. This is the V2 rocket. You can see it's quite a big machine and very impressive technology for the time. Despite the fact that it was a war machine, it's still pretty impressive. After that, people started doing experiments with rockets, putting experimental instruments on top of them and flying them up into the atmosphere. And rocketry developed a very active stage during the 60s and 70s. And then, of course, we moved on to the space shuttle, and I'll be coming back to the space shuttle a bit later on. And we have lots of satellites up there. We're heavily dependent on satellites. All of your iPhones and iPads and most communication around the world depends on satellites, whereas 30 years ago it depended on the ionosphere. And, of course, futuristically, we may be looking at future space travel, sometime off in the future, you know, seeing things zapping along at warp drive and all that sort of stuff. Although I have some comments about that later as well. So we're going to set ourselves in our little spaceship here, and we're going to try and take off, and we're going to go up through the atmosphere and just look at some of the things that we will have to take into account when we're trying to prepare our forecasts for our future travelers. Tropospheric stuff you're pretty familiar with, so I'll go through that quickly. This is the sort of stuff we deal with every day. If you're flying in a plane, you've got to worry about fog and cloud. You can't land very well in fog, so knowing how to predict that is important. Precipitation can be important. You all know that heavy rain can be bad up in the air as well as on the ground. Ice and snow can be pretty hazardous to flight. Lightning can be pretty nasty as well. And I should emphasize, every one of these slides I'm showing you is an area of active research in atmospheric physics. Good paying jobs, lots of stuff still to be discovered, and really interesting stuff. Severe winds can be obviously a strong hazard as well. Hurricanes, if you get to even more severity, and tornadoes, of course. And these are becoming more and more important as the world becomes more and more heavily populated, of course. But we know about that, so let's go a little bit higher. We know these are hazards, but we want to go upwards. So we go to the tropopause, the boundary between the troposphere and the stratosphere. There's a problem with this. People who don't work in the field think that this is some hard and fast layer which prevents movement of air between the troposphere and the stratosphere. In fact, nothing is further from the truth. NOAA has huge numbers of people just looking at the tropopause itself, because it turns out to be a very dynamic region. It particularly produces things called tropopause folds, where you actually have double tropopause, a lot of wave breaking and such like, and I'll get onto that later on in this region. A very active region, not nearly the staid level of the wall between the troposphere and the stratosphere that people used to believe. In fact, if you look at the latitudinal structure of the tropopause, at the equator, it starts at about 18 kilometers. Then in the mid latitudes, this is the equator up to the poles, and the heights over here, if you want to read heights. And of course, the pressure decreases as we go up in height as well. We're going to use that fact several times in this talk. Then there's an intermediate region where we actually often have a double tropopause. And then in the polar regions, in the Arctic and the Antarctic, we have a tropopause around 8 kilometers. So even from that picture, you can see that the tropopause is a fairly busy area of research, but it gets even busier when you start looking at day-to-day variations. Associated with the tropopause is the jet stream, and the jet stream is basically a river of air that runs around between the polar meteorological regions and the mid-latitude meteorological regions, and it is the major source of many of our severe weather events. The flow of the jet stream over the Rocky Mountains produces low-pressure systems such as the Alberta Clipper, the Colorado Low, which then come across and impact huge amounts of damage to us. So knowing about this is important for modern-day meteorology. If we decided to launch our rocket from the equator, which is not unusual because we can take advantage of the spin of the Earth to give us some initial speed, you actually come into a region which is also kind of dangerous. This shows radar maps as a function of time and backscattered intensity, which is basically a measure of the degree of turbulence. And because it's the equator and because it's so hot and humid there, it generates these huge, massive, turbulent eddies which work their way right up to 18 kilometers and punch a hole in the top of the troposphere and into the stratosphere. And you can see it's very dynamic. This region is the main region by which pollutants get from the troposphere into the stratosphere. The ozone hole, which a lot of you have heard about and which I won't talk about today, which involved a loss of huge amounts of ozone over the polar regions, the pollutants got there through the equator, through this system called the boiler box. So to understand the ozone hole over the poles, you have to understand the dynamics of the physics of the atmosphere at the equator. That's the sort of coupling I want you to bear in mind. That's why we need to see this in a global perspective. So for our rocket taking off here, these can represent very severe turbulence, and you've got to be careful when you do your launches. It also works the other way. I have a paper in Nature where we looked at ozone in the stratosphere flooding down into the troposphere. Ozone's a noxious gas. We want it up in the stratosphere because it protects us from ultraviolet light. We don't want it at ground level. It's a nasty gas at the ground level. And yet we find that it floods down frequently from the stratosphere. So the tropopause is an interesting area. Sometimes it's still and quiet, sometimes it's wild and turbulent, and there's a lot of cross-transport movement going on there. But to some extent, we even nowadays know a lot about that and have to know a lot about it just for ordinary flight in aircraft because we often fly in the stratosphere. So let's push on up a little bit to areas that are a bit more challenging. Let's go into the stratosphere and see what new physics and chemistry we need to learn there. This picture is a picture of one of my students, Merle Wright, took. It's a picture of a sunset, but you'll notice two other things. There's two little rainbows over here. These are called sun dogs. And they are caused by ice crystals high up in the troposphere and in the lower stratosphere, producing refraction effects, which produce little images of the sun which follow the sun around. Now, a lot of people, when they walk around, they look at the ground, or they look ahead, or they look at their iPads, but they don't often look up. And it's amazing how much you can see if you're willing to look up. And one of the best places for this is actually the Arctic and the Antarctic. I took Mel actually up to the Arctic at one stage, and the number of optical displays in the atmosphere up there is just staggering. You have sun dogs, you have iridescent clouds, you have sun pillars, a whole bunch of stuff, and I've got an entire website showing a lot of what these different optical phenomena are. And they're beautiful, beautiful in their own rights. But they tell us the atmosphere is cold. Really cold. And the pressure up there is getting less as well. So let me introduce a bit of thermodynamics. You hopefully are all familiar with this diagram. This is the phase diagram for water. We plot the temperature across here and pressure up here. And at these heights, we're in a region where the temperature is quite cold, below 0 degrees. The pressures are quite low. And so we're in a sublimation region. There's no liquid water in the stratosphere. Liquid water cannot exist for thermodynamical reasons. So everything is either ice or vapor. And this profoundly affects the way in which we look at the thermodynamic energy balance in the upper atmosphere and has very important implications when you bear in mind that a huge quantity of the heat that's transferred around the Earth is carried by water in the form of latent heat. You realize the importance of understanding this type of thing. So meteorologists spend a lot of time worrying about this type of stuff. So, okay, that's important, but is it going to affect our space flight? Overall, in the stratosphere, it's a region of cold temperatures, but the temperature is increasing as you go up in height, which should make it very stable. You've got hot air lying over top of cold air. That should make for stability. So you'd think the stratosphere would generally be a fairly good place to pass through. But no, we have a new complication. We produce waves. A rotating body with differential shear as a function of latitude instinctively produces waves, and these are massive waves. If you think about waves on an ocean, if you had a wave 100 foot high, you'd think that's a pretty big wave. These guys have amplitudes of thousands of kilometers, amplitudes of thousands of kilometers. They move material back and forth across the Earth's surface, distances of thousands of kilometers as they propagate around the world. These are massive. These are the biggest waves anywhere on the planet. And they turn out to be very important in affecting the dynamics. There's a whole class of waves. There's another class of waves you can see, again, if you look up. You'll often see banded structures in the sky that look something like this. This is taken in Abitibi Canyon, a place in northern Ontario, but you can see this anywhere you'd like to go. All these banded structures are also small-scale waves which propagate into the atmosphere. Now, to solve these is a very difficult process. Anyone who works in fluids has worked with the Navier-Stokes equations. We have to deal with the Navier-Stokes equations on a rotating Earth and also taking into account the effect of orography at the lower level. So it's a pretty massive computing exercise, but quite a fun one as well. So waves are important because they carry energy and they carry momentum, and as they go up, because the density of the atmosphere gets less, they get larger in amplitude and eventually break, just like waves break on the beach. When you encounter clear air turbulence when you're flying in an aircraft, it's waves that are producing it. It's nothing to do with the mountains underneath or friction with the ground. These waves produce all of the turbulence that occurs above the troposphere. So they have a profound effect if you're worried about turbulence, which is obviously something we would want to worry about if we were looking at travel through the atmosphere to space. Here's a blow-up of these waves. You can sort of see a little bit of a sinusoidal variation with height. It's not that evident, but I've sort of dotted it in to emphasize it. But these waves are real waves in a very real sense. But because there's so much noise around them, they're sometimes hard to pick out. Noise in the sense of other motions, such as turbulent motions. When these waves break, they produce what are called Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. You can see these things breaking here, just like waves at a beach. And again, this is a photo Mel took while we were in Resolute Bay. And these waves, when they break, they eventually break down your turbulence, which is the clear air turbulence that you may have encountered when you're traveling in an aircraft. With a radar, we can see the turbulence much better. You can see this double braided structure here. This is typical of Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, but just letting you know we have other ways of looking at it. So the stratosphere, we have two main effects. We have these waves become highly nonlinear, which makes dealing with them quite complicated. That means when they become nonlinear, they radiate other waves. So waves produce waves, produce waves. We have a chain reaction, so to speak. And so this air becomes full of waves. And the breakdown of the waves develops turbulence, which can be itself quite severe. So turbulence is an issue associated with these waves, but it's more important than that, much more important. Dynamically, these waves change the entire circulation of the atmosphere. Their very existence changes the flow of the Earth. Now, if you remember back to your early days of geography, you may remember the picture of the winds over the surface of the Earth looks something like this. We have a region in here where the air rises at the equator, heads towards the poles. It would like to go all the way up, but it doesn't. For various reasons, it falls back down and produces a circulation here. Where it produces a falling, it produces the deserts of the world. It drives a secondary circulation called the feral circulation, and that drives another circulation called the polar circulation. The details are not important. The key thing here is that this is all due to radiation effects from the sun. The heating of the sun drives the whole situation. In the upper atmosphere, it's different. We have to worry about these waves that I've discussed. So I've said here the lower atmospheric motions are largely driven by solar effects and what we call radiative balance, radiatively driven. But what about the upper atmosphere? Here we have to worry about the waves. And this has a very profound effect. Firstly, in the upper atmosphere, once you get into the stratosphere, you're above the clouds, above most of the clouds. The dominant heating is at the summer pole. We have a maximum of heating there because we have no clouds to stop us and we have 24 hours daylight. And the coldest spots, of course, are at the winter poles. And so this drives potentially a circulation which starts at the northern pole and ends at from the summer pole to the winter pole. Now, because of Coriolis effects, this translates itself to what we call a latitudinal motion around the globe, but it's a very different structure to what we expect for the troposphere, which is purely radiatively driven. Now, on top of this, there's this tendency to try and drive this north-south flow, but then these waves get involved, and they start dumping huge amounts of energy. They're very massive, and they dump energy in such a way that they change the circulation. I'm going to show you how dramatic that is shortly. The other thing that happens is we produce atmospheric tides. You think of tides in the ocean, they bring the water in, they bring it out. Tide might rise and fall a few feet, or in some places maybe 30 or 40 feet. The tides in the atmosphere manifest themselves as pressure and velocity variations, and the velocity amplitudes of a tide can reach 200 kilometers an hour. So the winds up there are 200 kilometers an hour or more, up in the upper levels of the upper stratosphere and getting higher. And they rotate as a function of time of day. During 24-hour period, they might go from the north to the east, to the south, to the west, and back again. And this is atmospheric tides. And you'll see why I think that's important later on. So we're pushing on upwards. We've gone through the stratosphere. We've recognized the importance of these planetary waves. And I've told you they'll change the circulation, but I'm going to give you more details in a minute. We're now going to push on up into the mesosphere. The mesosphere is an even lower density region. Water vapor is pretty much gone. The heating distribution, again, becomes mainly a pole-to-pole distribution. But importantly, those little tiny waves I showed you, the ones we saw in the clouds, which are called gravity waves, which are not gravitational waves, they're not the things that cosmologists deal with. These are waves that exist in the air, but they are dominated by the influence of gravity. These guys propagate upwards, become very large in amplitude because of the decreasing density, and as a consequence, they start to break. And when they break, they dump energy into the upper atmosphere. They produce large amounts of turbulence, but they also dump energy and momentum, which has an important effect. And so in the mesosphere, buoyancy waves and tides become a problem, and you'll see why that is shortly. Here's a picture of a gravity wave in the upper atmosphere taken with an infrared camera. These waves affect the chemistry in the upper atmosphere, which means they emit infrared radiation, and we can photograph them. And you can see this is basically an all-sky camera view showing this banded structure moving across the sky. And the turbulence can be very strong. In this case here, we've taken a rocket, we've released a vapor trail, and we've photographed. You can see it's become all turbulence and bubbly down around here. Up here, it's become more laminar, and there are reasons for that, which we won't discuss today. But the key thing is this turbulence. If you measure the strength of that turbulence, the energy deposition per unit kilogram is equal to that occurs in a major storm here on Earth, or here down on the lower levels. It's pretty severe stuff. The thing that saves our rocket ship is the fact that the density is much less. the density up there, the density decreases by a factor of 10 every 16 kilometers. So at these heights, we've reduced our density by 1,000 times. So this becomes less of a problem. But it's still pretty severe stuff. So it's gravity waves, these buoyancy waves or gravity waves, which are the main problem for us at these heights. By now, they've gone from amplitudes at the ground of a few tens of centimeters per second to amplitudes of 30 or 40 meters per second, and they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere in the upper atmosphere. They start at the ground by various different ways. Flowover mountains are the easiest one to envisage, but we can produce it by large convective swells. We can produce it at frontal systems. We can produce it, even eclipses produce gravity waves. But here's our flow over a mountain, producing some lenticular clouds along the way. These things are produced and propagate upwards. Now, I'd like to spend a lot of time talking about the gravity waves and how they're formed and what the physics of them is, but I'll give that a miss. The key thing to note, quite an interesting effect, is that the phase velocity of the wave propagates this way. The group velocity propagates at 90 degrees to it. Most people, when they deal with phase and group velocity, you think of them moving in the same direction. But these waves are very unique, and they're just here on Earth. They're just standard waves here on Earth with phase and group velocities which are completely 90 degrees to each other, which is actually kind of paradoxical. As the waves go up, they grow in amplitude, and they start at the ground with speeds of a few tens of centimeters per second. By the time they reach here, their amplitudes can be 10, 20, 30 meters per second, and then they start to break. This shows the impact of these waves. These are special clouds. They're called noctilucent clouds. They're the highest clouds that occur anywhere on Earth. Most clouds finish by the time you get to the stratosphere. These noctilucent clouds are unique to the polar system, and they occur at 80 kilometers in height. And you can see all this banded structure through there, really emphasizing, these are taken in Sweden, really emphasizing these waves. Now, this is important because these waves, when they propagate up, this special, you've got to go through all the mathematics and details of the filtering processes and the way they break and the way they're absorbed and the way they damp energy. But in the end, they have a big effect on the structure of the atmosphere. So this summarizes where we're up to now. At the lower atmosphere, this height goes from 16 to 100 kilometers or so, and from the summer to the winter poles. And here's the equator. So in the lowest levels, below 16 kilometers, we have that three-structure system I showed you earlier, the Hadley cell, the Ferrel cell, and the polar cells. As you get up into the stratosphere, you get a different circulation called the Brewer-Dobson circulation, where you have air rising at the poles, at the equator, but going all the way to the poles. And this phenomenon is due to those planetary waves that I discussed with you before. The planetary waves drive a different circulation. And when you go even higher, the planetary waves are less important, and gravity waves start to play a role, and then you have this entire pole-to-pole circulation, which is driven by the gravity waves. Now, it's easy to say, who cares, as long as it doesn't destroy our little spacecraft, but let me show you the importance. If you take a model and produce the temperature distribution using traditional theory without taking these waves into account, so we're going from the summer pole to the winter pole, you get the non-surprising result that it's very, very cold in the upper levels of the atmosphere during winter. That's what you'd expect. Winter should be cold, right? Observationally, the coldest place on Earth is in the summer at 80 degrees north. This is a realistic application of a theory that I've just been through. It completely reverses the entire flow compared to what you would expect and completely reverses the heating effects in the atmosphere. These temperatures are so cold you could run a high temperature superconductor there. They're 120 degrees Kelvin. So this is a pretty dramatic change just due to those waves. And you can imagine if we're trying to make forecasts for our future space travelers, not knowing about this could be a very, very serious problem. So you not just got it wrong, you got it completely wrong. So getting this right and understanding these waves is absolutely critical to understanding the future. Am I running out of time? About 4 minutes. Okay, so let me move on to show you why this is important. This comes out of an incident called the Space Shuttle Columbia accident back in 2003, when the Space Shuttle Columbia coming down was destroyed with all the astronauts on board. When that happened, NASA contacted me and said, what happened here? And they sent me a nice little citation afterwards, so you can believe that what I tell you is true. I have a system of meteor radars all around the world, which enables me to measure the wind speeds at the height that this thing came down, or just above it. We can measure from 75 to 100 kilometers. So we got to work with all of this data and started producing maps of what the winds look like in the upper atmosphere. And this one shows an example of over Maui when the space shuttle went through this vertical line. You can see these bands coming down. This is time along here and height up across there. These are atmospheric tides, and you can see they're as big as I said they are, 50 meters per second. So we put all this together. We were able to show that the dominant motions at the time in this region were a two-day wave and a tide, a 24-hour tide. Basically, I've drawn this in what I can best schematic way that I can. This is the two-day wave. It's actually a mode 3 wave which rotates around the Earth, and the tide here. And basically, those two added up together to produce very, very strong wind shears just at the height the shuttle came down. Now, the eventual conclusion of NASA was that the space shuttle was destroyed by foam that damaged the aircraft or the spacecraft when it took off, and then it was compromised when it came down. But I did this work before they'd made that conclusion. We did a lot of computer modeling to try and look for these effects. We compared the computer models to our experimental results and found that they had reasonable agreement. And then we started looking around. We said, well, okay, it looks like we have strong wind shears. Did we have a strong layers of turbulence? And there wasn't any evidence. There's regions of clear temperature instability where the temperature is decreasing around the height that it burned up. But more importantly to me were these two regions of very stable air. And they're ones that people had ignored up till this point in time. But I knew that these gravity waves that I discussed earlier, these buoyancy waves, get much larger in amplitude when they reach stable regions. So I decided to do the drag analysis on a spaceship as it comes down through the atmosphere. So we use standard drag equations. Remember, the spaceship is coming down with its bottom along the trajectory because it wants to slow itself down as fast as possible. So the drag forces are going to be enormous. And the traditional idea is if you hit a patch of turbulence, the turbulence will buffet you around and cause you a problem. But I wanted to go through the theory from first principles again. This is where the physics comes in. So we assume that there's velocity fluctuations, but I also assume there's density fluctuations. It's normal in that equation to assume the density is fixed, but I know gravity waves produce density fluctuations. So I did the analysis more thoroughly than had previously been done before, and the bottom line was I ended up with an equation for the drag, which depended on the RMS velocity, so the level of turbulence. But it also depended on a parameter called beta, which relates to the density fluctuations, and the speed mu zero. And what it turns out from the bottom of all this analysis is, if you are moving at slow speeds, like Mach 1, speed of sound, yes, the normal process is what you'd experience on an aircraft with buffeting from the turbulence of from the motion of the air particles. But if you're moving at 20 times the speed of sound, which this aircraft was, it hits the density fluctuations created by the gravity waves. It's like driving along a bumpy road. Boom, 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 boom. And so the motion of the aircraft actually forces you through these bumps in the air, forced by the gravity waves, and produces very severe forces. So this is something that NASA was unaware of at the time, is that the most dangerous places when you're coming back into the atmosphere are the regions of highest stability, not the regions of highest instability. And they've adjusted their checks to look at that now. So I still believe that this had an impact on the space shuttle Columbia, in that if the spacecraft was compromised, hitting all these bumps along the way would have finished it off. So it's a warning of things we have to watch in the future. And the astronauts later told me that they've experienced these things all the time, and they call them potholes in the sky. So that's application of basic physics to try and attack a problem which had an unusual solution. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on, so I'm told I have to finish up, so I'll mention them briefly. This is getting most people like reading about this sort of stuff, so you're probably familiar with it. The stuff I've shown you sort of seems bland to people, which is why I concentrated on that. But you encounter things called sprites and elves, which are massive lightning discharges upward into the atmosphere. You have huge vertical electric fields. A lot of interesting chemistry going on in the upper atmosphere. And of course, these are the things you're all familiar with. Meteors, lots of little particles coming in from space. So they are obviously a hazard or potential hazard, although they haven't proved that to be too much of a hazard, but they have destroyed at least two or three satellites by hitting them in the wrong way and causing chemical reactions involved in the electronics of these satellites. The aurora, another area due to the magnetic fields of the Earth, which can be pretty nasty places as well if you try flying through one of those. I mentioned already the importance of the magnetic field, even right out into space. You've still got to worry about things like Van Allen belts and so forth. And the aurora themselves can be pretty nasty. Even down here on ground level, they can completely destroy electrical grid systems. There's an article in Scientific American about that recently. And of course, once you get into space, you have to worry about particles. And I just want to finish with one final comment. People talk about, you know, taking a spaceship from ship from here to Alpha Centauri and exploring space. And of course, the standard way to do it is to get your aircraft up to traveling at speeds close to the speed of light, so your time slows down. Well, a sobering thought for you. If you travel at 10% of the speed of light, which means almost no time dilation at all, and you hit a rock the size of my thumbnail, the energy released is that of a nuclear explosion. So we're not going to be traveling at the speed of light, because there's so many other little particles out there we're going to run into. So if you're talking about serious space travel, that is a limitation that people don't conveniently forget, but which is a serious limitation, which is going to keep us prisoners here in our solar system for some time to come. And if we do have visitors from space, and they've had to experience this, they didn't come here for a picnic. So it's a sobering point to bear in mind. It's a bit like the Pilgrim Fathers crossing to America. They didn't come there to have a picnic and go back to Europe. So if we have visitors from space, they're going to have fairly evil intent. So anyway, I was going to show you a bunch of pictures of some of the cool instruments we use to study the atmosphere, but I think I've been hassled to finish. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? We've got about 2 minutes.
So for what I understand, gravity is a constant. Can you explain again how does gravity create a wave?
Sorry?
So for what I understand, gravity is a constant.
Yes.
But how can you explain again how does gravity create a wave?
No, it's not the gravity that's the wave. The gravity is just a forcing mechanism. Uh-huh. Gravity wave is nothing but a sound wave, but including the effects of gravity. So you have effects of buoyancy. So the effect of buoyancy is that, you know, if you take a particle in the air and you displace it downwards, it starts bouncing and starts oscillating up and down. And so they're called gravity waves because the effect of gravity, which is a constant, has an extra effect which totally changes the nature of buoyancy waves relative to what you're familiar with as sound waves.
So it's similar to the water surface wave?
It's exactly the same as the water surface. You have the water surface lifts up, it overshoots, then it goes back down and produces a wave. The difference with the atmosphere is we have a density gradient which decreases uniformly, but it's the same sort of principle.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? So another question about the buoyancy waves. You mentioned that the wave velocity is perpendicular to the group velocity. Uh-huh. What sort of boundary conditions are necessary in order for the solutions to, like in numerical solutions, what sort of boundary conditions are necessary in order to be able to model that?
This just falls out naturally. There's no particular boundary conditions. People solve these waves all the time. It's a manifestation of the fact that the gravity is trying to force the thing up and down while the forcing mechanism is trying to force it in a different direction and the two working together. And when I say 9 degrees, it's almost 9 degrees. It's not exactly 9 degrees. And so you have this issue of the energy propagating in one direction and the wave in the other. I can show you with the little diagram I had there a bit later on. You can see it more physically if you want me to show you that. But essentially, it's a natural consequence. It doesn't require anything about boundary conditions at all. It's just a natural result of the dispersion relations. The other thing about the waves, which may partly explain your question, is they're very dispersive. Their velocity of propagation depends on their frequency. And it's that characteristic that makes it so that d omega by dk is perpendicular to omega over k.
So you also mentioned that there are solitonic solutions that occur in these.
I didn't mention it, but yes.
Well, it said on the slide.
But there are solitonic.
So what kind of effects do those end up having? Like, how do those show up?
They show up, well, we call them bores. You can actually see them in the ground level. In Darwin, for example, you often have a thing called the morning glory, which is a bore wave moving in. They're essentially a Fourier composition of gravity waves, which happen to produce a nice sharp edge, which moves along as a single soliton. But they show up in various different ways. They particularly occur in ducted regions where you have essentially a natural duct formed by the temperature and wind profiles which cause these waves to propagate along. But in mathematically, they're very similar to the bores that you are commonly quoted in the United Kingdom where you have the channels where you have the tide comes in and comes out, and you have these bore waves that move down through. So physically, they look similar to that. But the thing about them is they can get quite large amplitude and actually can cause quite nasty accidents to aircraft and such like.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Alrighty, I think we have to take a break now. So thank you very much to both our speakers this morning. I have to give them another round of applause for those talks.